It's not the end of the world. No, no, at least it's not the end of the world. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Russell Rumbaugh, a co-director for budgeting for foreign affairs and defense programs at the Stimson Center. Previously, he was a defense analyst on the Senate Budget Committee and served as military legislative assistant to Congressman Jim Cooper of Tennessee, and was a lead staffer for Mr. Cooper as chairman of the House Armed Services Committee's panel on roles and missions. He also served as operations research analyst at the Office of Secretary of Defense's Program Analysis and Evaluation, as a military analyst at the Central Intelligence Agency, and as an infantry officer in the United States Army, resigning with the rank of captain. Welcome to Background Briefing, Russell Rumbaugh.
Thanks so much for having me.
And the report that you've done for the Stimson Center, What We Bought, Defense Procurement from Fiscal Year 01 to Fiscal Year 2010, indicates that procurement funding grew dramatically from $62.6 billion to $135.8 billion. So does that mean then that the Secretary Panetta is faced with, having to cut more than $450 billion over the next decade, is there anything to be taken out of procurement then?
Well, unfortunately, the question goes the other way of not is there something to be taken out of procurement, but procurement will be taken out of. The defense budget traditionally cycles. It has fat years and lean years. And every time we turn into a downturn, it's true that procurement pays first. Now, what is often forgotten is although procurement always pays during the down cycles, procurement always also grows faster during the up cycles. And that's one of the things the report does, is go back and look what happened during that up cycle that we've just been through. Did we manage to buy anything while times were good?
Well, wouldn't the real question be, did we buy anything that we really need? Because isn't there a tendency to fight the last war?
Well, actually, I think the more interesting question is the one Secretary Gates posed, of less the tendency to fight the last war as the tendency to fight the next war. As Gates called it, next war-itis. Now, he's not talking about the operations and tactics, but rather about procurement. Our system has a really endemic effort to always look forward. The contractors are always trying to sell the military on the next new thing, the military is always trying to sell Congress on the next new thing, and Congress is trying to prove to its constituents that it's gotten the next new thing, which means we are always looking forward. Sometimes we can get a skewed perspective of where we're at because of that constant look forward.
Well, what we know is that the defense spending has doubled to $700 billion a year since 9/11. What have we got for that money? Because obviously a war on terror is a pretty amorphous thing. You know, it's a war against a tactic, not against anything that that we're used to in an historical military context.
And despite that, I'm sure most people won't be surprised that the stuff we got isn't really very amorphous. It looks like the stuff we have often bought: ships, tanks, airplanes. You've already brought it up. The really important question is, have we bought the right stuff? Unfortunately, there's never an easy answer to have we bought the right stuff. What does the future hold? What fight are we going to be doing? You can look back the last 10 years and realize we didn't quite have the right stuff when we started these wars. Now, will we and do we have the right stuff for the future?
Well, we also have to add the fact that that everything's on the chopping block, right? If Russell Rumbaugh, if the super committee can't come to an agreement, there will be across-the-board cuts. And that, I mean, Panetta is faced with taking out more than $450 billion over the next decade. That's his mission. But if the super committee can't come to an agreement, then the axe comes down, right? if it deadlocks and fails to find the $1.2 trillion, these automatic cuts, the Pentagon would face a $500 billion in additional reductions over the next decades. So clarify that for us. I mean, in other words, Panetta's supposed to take out $450 billion. What happens if the super committee can't come to an agreement?
So the $450 billion, you've absolutely said it right. And in fact, we talked about this at the start of the program. $450 billion over 10 years out of something approaching a $6 or $7 trillion defense budget isn't that much, especially compared to past drawdowns. It's only about 80%, whereas the drawdowns in the 90s or in the 70s were more around 30%. Sequester adds a whole other dynamic. To be honest, even at the increased dollar level, that still is not at the drawdown levels we've seen in the past. But it happens in a much different way. It happens in a single year, 10% drop, and as you said, across the board cuts. There's no strategic decision here. There's no choosing what's the best thing we have and what's the worst thing we have. It's every single line item takes a 10% cut, which clearly is not a strategic solution to a defense budget crunch.
Well, but just in terms of drawdowns and the recent ones that you mentioned, mm-hmm. where are we now? Because we're getting out of Iraq by December the 31st, and we're getting out of Afghanistan starting in 2014. What's the defense budget likely to look like? Say, apparently the Defense Department itself is saying that its spending will drop to $522.5 billion by 2017.
And of course, it's only talking about the base budget. It's not actually. It's always kept the war budget in a separate conversation. In FY11, we spent $160 billion. Now,
right.
So far, the administration has only asked for, in the recent continuing resolution, has only given $126 billion for FY12. So that's a pretty significant drop already. Nevertheless, I think most people are less concerned about how the war cost drawdown is what is our steady-state defense spending, which, even without the war costs, went up dramatically in the last decade. Is it going to go down now, and how deep is it going to go? Certainly, that's what sequester is pointing out. War costs are exempt from sequester. And it's what the $450 billion you mentioned is coming out of, not war costs, but base costs.
So if the base cost is about $530 billion, mm-hmm. and the defense spending stands at $700 billion, explain to me what all of that amount above $530 gets us.
Well, there's two parts. $530 is the Department of Defense. There is a broader budget category called national defense, and that includes the nuclear weapons activities that are in the Department of Energy, and it includes some other monies that go, for instance, to the Coast Guard and the Department of Homeland Security. But that's only about $25 billion. The bulk of the number to get us above $700 billion is those war costs. $530 is FY11 base, and there was $160 billion or $159.3 billion in FY11. That's what takes you above $700 billion.
Again, I'm speaking with Russell Rumbaugh, who is a co-director for budgeting for foreign affairs and defense programs at the Stimson Center, previously was the defense analyst on the Senate Budget Committee, and also serves as an operations research analyst at the Office of Secretary of Defense's Program Analysis and Evaluation, as a military analyst at the Central Intelligence Agency, and as an infantry officer in the United States Army, resigning with the rank of captain. So I remember years ago, I used to talk with an old friend going back to the Vietnam War days, Colonel David Hackworth, who unfortunately is no longer with us. But he was the most highly decorated living soldier, I think, in the U.S. Army. He said that he always referred to the dichotomy within the army and within the military as the choices between the toys and the boys. So where's that stand now? Because the new plans are to cut a lot of cut the army down in number, the Marines down in number. There's even talk of TRICARE, which is the Department of Defense's health program, which has doubled in cost, I think, in the last decade, I believe. Yeah, it's gone up from $50 billion to $50 billion. So Give me a sense of how much we're going to be cutting hardware and how much we're going to be cutting from manpower and pay and benefits.
Well, your toys and boys conundrum is absolutely the most interesting question about this build down. In previous build downs, the force had always been at a larger number than before. That was especially true at the end of the Cold War. They dropped the number by 700,000. This time, our force is about the same. And in fact, the Air Force and the Navy are smaller than they were in 2000, despite the increase in the defense budget. In fact, both the Air Force and the Navy tried to go down lower in personnel and found they needed to put their people back to make sure they could maintain their current force structure. The Army always feels like it suffers the most because it is so dependent on people and so is most sensitive to the budget top lines. The next 10 years are going to be really interesting to see, are we going to face a fundamental choice because of those built-in personnel costs? That is exacerbated by the other point you made about health care costs. Health care costs have grown, and of course, although they've grown a great deal for the Department of Defense, that isn't unique to the Department of Defense. Healthcare costs are growing throughout the country, and that becomes a reality that we have to deal with in the future. It's not necessarily something that can just be solved by making a different choice, and that's going to put greater stress on our other choices, the toys versus boys you signed up. Do we keep buying stuff? Do we keep buying the same stuff? Do we keep buying the same force structure, most importantly?
So in terms of the report that you did, Russell Rumbaugh, for the Stimson Center, what we bought defense procurement from fiscal year 01 to fiscal year 2010, just briefly go through, if you will, because we've bought the F-22 fighter. There's been a lot of a lot of criticism about whether and that's the most effective platform out there. The C-17, I think didn't we buy more than we needed? I think the Pentagon wanted to close the line, but I think our local senators out here kept it open in Long Beach. So we know about how the system works with going back to Eisenhower's warning. So give us an assessment of what we've bought now to the point where maybe we don't need to buy any more. And because my understanding is that Gates tried to reorient spending towards drones and cyber warfare and things that he felt were 21st century as opposed to big expensive toys.
Well, I think the most important thing my report takes away with is often people assume that the money we've spent in the last 10 years was consumed by the war, that because this money, because these wars are going on, so much of the money we spend is disappearing in daily operations. And certainly there's some of that. But in just terms of procurement, which is buying stuff, only 8% of the $1 trillion we spent on procurement was spent on ammunition. And that 8% number includes things like missiles, not just the rounds being fired by individual soldiers' rifles. So 92% of funding was spent on other stuff. And not surprisingly, when you spend more than $900 million on stuff, you get some pretty good stuff. Unfortunately, to look at what you bought, the only way to do it is go service by service, because each of them control their own acquisition strategy, and each of them are pursuing the priorities they think are most important. You brought up the Air Force, which is one of the most telling examples, because the Air Force clearly made a choice. They chose quality. They had the number one and number two largest procurement programs within the Department of Defense last 10 years, the F-22 and the C-17, both of which you mentioned. Now, first of all, both of those aircraft are incredible aircraft. They do things nothing else in their class does. There's a reason they are such high-end aircraft. They truly do things nobody else can imagine. But, of course, that has a price. They are also more expensive than other types of planes. What's better, buying a lot of something cheaper or buying a few of something more? Well, that always depends on the situation. But it's the choice the Air Force made was to buy few at a high price. And because of that, we have the best fighter aircraft in the world and we have the best transport aircraft in the world. I'm sorry, I just have to defend Congress a little bit. Yes, Secretary Gates made the C-17 a great example of Congress buying things the Pentagon didn't want. Of course, it's always interesting to figure out whether just because the Pentagon wants it means it's necessary or not. The original plan was to buy more than 200 C-17s, and that was brought down in the 90s when times were tight. Congress forced the Pentagon to buy more than they expected. But, of course, Congress is the one who has the power of the purse, and they're the ones who are going to make that choice in the end.
But this is a zero-sum game. So your question you really have to ask yourself, Russell Rumbaugh, is do we need the extra transportation as opposed to what Gates was wanting, which was more drones? And he apparently was getting resistance from the Air Force because they don't like pilotless aircraft. And now apparently drones are literally pilots actually use the toggle switch, from what my understanding.
The opportunity costs are always the question. Obviously, you would like to have anything and everything, but that's not possible for anybody, including the Department of Defense, despite the sums we spent. There's always more you could have. And the drones are one of the most interesting stories out there. The Air Force, for a number of years, has claimed to be following a high-low strategy. They would buy a few of very high-end aircraft and buy a lot of a lower-end aircraft. That's what they did in the 1980s, buying the F-15 and the F-16. F-15 was very high-end and a little bit expensive. The F-16 was very cheap, but they could buy a lot of it. Because of Secretary Gates' pressure on the drones, the Air Force has sort of backed into a high-end, high-low strategy. They have the F-22 on the high-end, and then they have these pilotless drones, which now there's several hundred of them already in the inventory because of this last decade's spending.
And I take it that there'll be more. I mean, don't they want to go from the one that they have now to the Reaper? Is that the new one?
That's right. And in fact, they've already started buying the Reaper within the last 10 years. Not only did they field the first generation drone, the Predator, mm-hmm. bought several hundred of them. They've already developed and fielded the next generation, the Reaper, which they have bought, and they've already bought about 30% of the total they plan on buying for that aircraft as well. So the good times are good times, and the Air Force and everybody else managed to buy a lot of what they wanted, more than they originally expected.
Well, now we get to the crunch, Russell Rumbaugh. When you talk about the good times, the good times are over for a lot of Americans, right? I mean, we got people camping out in the streets around the country, and we've got a real sense that there is a serious fiscal crisis in this country. You've got Tea Party members and liberals in Congress arguing that the cuts that Panetta is about to make, the $450 billion, are not sufficient. There is this sense out there that there has to be, talk about across-the-board cuts, there has to be across-the-board sacrifices.
Well, and again, I would refer, let's discuss what we've seen in the past. The cuts being talked about right now are really small compared to past drawdowns. Now, some of that will be eaten up by the war funding going down as well. But nevertheless, right now, we're just at the start of it. The FY11 budget basically froze the Defense Department budget at its FY10 levels. That's not quite a drawdown yet. That's more just the inflection point. And we still don't have a final number for FY12 as the appropriators make their final dispositions here in the coming weeks. And we'll see if that starts tipping down a little bit more, and it's in these coming years under the caps of the Budget Control Act that's likely to really start biting.
So I guess the takeaway then from this conversation is that these dire threats that are coming or these doomsday scenarios from people saying that, you know, that the across-the-board cuts will be a disaster, that you're suggesting that to head that off in Panetta's task of taking out $450 billion is not going to be that difficult.
It's still going to feel painful, even though we've done it before and we're likely to do it again. It's tough to compare. The U.S. military is so much bigger and better than anything else in the world. The doomsday scenarios don't really have anything to compare to. Nevertheless, the U.S. military also does more than anybody else in the world, and that demand keeps up a large number of requirements, even when times are tough. Nevertheless, given our debts and deficits, it seems very clear that the defense budget will be going down in the coming years.
But just an added thought, though. My understanding is that with Petraeus at the CIA, with what happened in Libya, there's a lot of talk now, isn't there, of that lots of boots on the ground are counterproductive. Arguably, they were counterproductive in Iraq, and they played into Bin Laden's playbook. And some people argue they're counterproductive in Afghanistan, given how few boots on the ground originally defeated the Taliban in the early part of that war. So, aren't we heading into a new strategic landscape where there'll be fewer boots on the ground, more use of local assets, but use of drones and air power and naval power, which is what we're doing in Somalia, right? We're using the Ugandans and the Kenyans to do the fighting. We use the Libyans to liberate themselves. Is that where we're heading?
Well, most interestingly from a defense budget perspective is the defense budget is broken up traditionally in very even amounts. It's roughly a third to the Army, a third to the Navy, and a third to the Air Force. And that has been true ever since the end of the Vietnam War. Now, all those issues you just described, interesting, you can hear the Navy and Air Force talk about that, talk about how our futures in the Pacific were not actually going to be occupying countries. What we haven't yet heard is either the Navy or the Air Force saying, oh, the Army's budget should go down. What we have heard is the other side. The Secretary of the Army has said, I believe even though the defense budget is going down, that one-third, one-third, one-third is going to continue, and the Army will continue to get its share. Obviously, that's a little bit different than your question, which is predicated on strategy. And what I just described, how can, as an old boss used to say, the service shares have remained the same from hot war, cold war, and no war. That is a dynamic we'll wait to see in this next 10 years of whether that becomes disconnected and we actually make a strategic choice about how to spend our defense budget.
Well, I thank you for joining us today, Russell Rumbaugh.
Well, thank you very much for the time, and I hope it was worthwhile.
It definitely was. And again, I've been speaking with Russell Rumbaugh, who's co-director for budgeting for Foreign Affairs and Defense Program at the Stimson Center. Previously, he was a defense analyst on the Senate Budget Committee, and he also served as an operations research analyst at the in the Office of Secretary of Defense's Program Analysis and Evaluation, and as a military analyst at the Central Intelligence Agency, and as an infantry officer in the United States Army, resigning with the rank of captain. Let's take a brief station break, and we'll be back with another perspective on cutting the defense budget.
At least, it's not the end of the world. It's not the end.